Vulnerable population for babies, for our former premature infants. If you have a baby under the age of 6 months, now is not a time to go out to the mall with that baby or to be around a lot of people in a crowded environment. Hand washing, making sure your children are up to date on their vaccines, including their influenza and their COVID vaccine. Co-infection is becoming more of an issue. So it is really important to take these common sense precautions to keep children safe and really to keep our healthcare system afloat at this point.
Dr. Christina Probst, we thank you so much for being with us, a pediatrician in Houston, Texas. Tune in on November 8th for our 3-hour election night special. We'll begin broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for a video news production fellowship and a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
Supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
The KBOO Evening News produces a nightly one-hour newscast every weekday night. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training in writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. For more information, email newsdirector at kboo.org.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, people react strongly on both sides to a new plan targeting houselessness in Portland.
Unfortunately, like a poison pill, Agenda Item 901 does slip in that camping ban.
It's the 25th anniversary of Oregon's groundbreaking law allowing dying with dignity. And new information is released about the treatment of protesters in Portland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 27th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Parts of a Department of Homeland Security report on Portland protesters are now public. As KBOO's Josh Salem reports, some of the newly released information seems to be highly political.
A Department of Homeland Security report detailing the agency's collection of information on Portland racial justice protesters in 2020 has been released, nearly in its entirety. A heavily redacted version of the report was released previously in 2021. The new portions, available now to the public, show that Acting Secretary of Homeland Security Chad Wolf and Acting Deputy Secretary Ken Cuccinelli try to politicize intelligence operations in Portland. Some feel they pushed constitutional boundaries. The unredacted portions of the report describe the two agency heads requesting operational background reports on every person who attended protests. That request could have led to the collection of dossiers on potentially thousands of Portlanders. It was apparently motivated by a belief that a U.S. person was funding the protests in the city. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and other members of Oregon's congressional delegation have pressed the Justice Department and Department of Homeland Security for more details about the Trump administration's response to the 2020 racial justice protests for years. In a statement, Wyden said Oregonians have a right to a full accounting of the Trump administration's, quote, twisted efforts to provoke violence in Portland for his political gain, end quote. He added, now the public knows much more about how political DHS officials spied on Oregonians for exercising their First Amendment right to protest and justified it with baseless conspiracy theories. Instead of compiling reports on every protest attendee, as originally directed, the Department of Homeland Security put together information only on people who had been arrested or charged with violent acts. Those reports include past criminal history, travel history, and so-called derogatory information from DHS or intelligence community holdings, as well as publicly available social media. The intelligence collection coincided with a federal law enforcement Portland deployment in 2020. The Trump administration said that Portland was under siege by what the administration characterized as violent Antifa terrorists. The unredacted report appears to be in line with that characterization. The report says that Acting Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis Brian Murphy's intended purpose was to use the data to confirm his suspicions that a link existed among the arrestees and identify a single individual or group that was masterminding the attacks. Murphy told analysts to refer to protesters as, quote, violent Antifa anarchist inspired, end quote, a demand analysts had long stated was not founded in any of their intelligence collection. The newly unredacted portions note that analysts had been telling Murphy that Antifa was not in the collection and could not be put in the analysis. The unredacted report was released after the current Undersecretary for Intelligence and Analysis revised the organization's public records policies at Wyden's request. The new policy requires the disclosure of sources and methods unless said disclosure would materially negate their effectiveness. Portland was one of several cities seeing large protests after George Floyd's murder. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Portland's Mayor Ted Wheeler announced a plan targeting homelessness, which would include a street camping ban, the creation of large homeless campsites, and increased construction of affordable housing. It's a proposal that brought out lots of testimony and emotion. Among the hundreds testifying was Kaya Sand, the executive director of Street Roots, a newspaper in Portland that creates income opportunities for people struggling with homelessness and poverty. She told city council members that input from unhoused Portlanders is vital and that camping bans are not a good answer.
I'm the executive director of Street Roots, and upstairs in our Old Town office, many, many people have gathered, many who are experiencing street homelessness. They're watching this hearing on a big sheet, and that's because, quite frankly, that you hold power over their lives. And I'm downstairs. This is our newspaper archive, and we serve as a public memory. I'm holding, actually, newspapers from 25 years ago, when we were the Burnside Cadillac, covering camping bans. And I can tell you again and again and again, camping bans come up as something politicians brandish to placate some constituents while making life unbearable for others. And this repeats itself. And I'm happy to give you 25 years of history, but we'll do that in next issue of that legal history of camping bans, mayors, and Portland. But in the meantime, I'm really happy to see that you've sketched out these ambitious goals for affordable housing, for addressing legal entanglements, for low barrier work. This is all very hopeful. And although lacking development, I think agenda items 899, 900, and 903 sketch out a horizon in which we can set our gaze as a community and show an intention to work with the other jurisdictions and the hard work they've been doing. So thank you. Unfortunately, like a poison pill, Agenda item 901 does slip in that camping ban. And I need to pull back the veil on something you said in the beginning, Mayor Wheeler. I know you've been talking about outreach. The only evidence we've found is two outreach workers with the impact reduction team. And I need to really emphasize, for the last 24 hours, Afro Village Portland, Blanche House, Ground Score Association, Join, Impact Northwest, Northwest Pilot Project, Our Just Future, Outside In, Pair, Rose Haven, Sisters of the Road, Street Roots, Urban League, Street Books, on and on. We have been hustling. We have no evidence of outreach, and so we have been fighting to make sure that happens. We thank you, Mayor Wheeler. We thank you, Commissioner Ryan, for accepting an invitation to have a town hall next week with unhoused people. But I need to make sure that you do understand that part of your work is the extended engagement with the people on whose lives your policy impacts.
That was the testimony of Kaya Sand, Executive Director of Street Roots, to Portland City Council. The members expect to hear more testimony and vote on November 3rd. An Oregon judge revoked a $77,000 campaign fine against Portland City Council candidate Renee Gonzalez today, saying no campaign finance violations were committed. Gonzalez was initially slapped with a hefty fine in September by the city's Small Donors Elections Program when his campaign did not report a significant discount to rent an office space in downtown Portland. The space in question has been charging Gonzalez's campaign just $250 a month, though evidence was presented suggesting the rent for the space had been advertised at $26 per square foot, equaling $6,900 a monthly rent. Judge Joe Allen wrote in an 18-page opinion that the city failed to carry its burden to demonstrate that the discounted office space constituted contributions because its fair market value exceeded the amount paid. Portland Election Commission Chair Amy Sample Ward says she's stunned by the decision and that it's created a loophole for donors, rendering contribution regulations useless. Ward notes the city may appeal the decision, but recommended that current program rules be amended to address future instances. Gonzalez is running against incumbent Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty in the November election. In the Oregon governor's race, Democrat Tina Kotek is getting a boost from Bernie Sanders, while Republican Christine Drazen is getting another financial contribution from Nike founder Phil Knight. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade reports.
Nike co-founder Phil Knight has anteed up another hefty check in support of Republican gubernatorial candidate Christine Drazen, bringing his total contributions towards the campaign to well over $1 million. Knight wrote a check for $500,000 for the Republican nominee on October 25th, though it was disclosed today. Oregon hasn't elected a Republican governor since 1982, but analysts say due to a divided field and from big buck endorsements, such as the accumulative $1.5 million granted by Knight, that Drazen may just eke out a victory in November. Knight has also funneled millions to unaffiliated candidate Betsy Johnson, helping her attract roughly 14% in recent polls, numbers that could suggest dissatisfaction with some of the state's on-the-fence Democratic voters. Advocates for climate change are expressing concern over the possibility of Drazen landing the state's top spot, in part due to her connection with the conservative pro-logging grassroots group Timber Unity, whose leaders have been linked to alt-right militias. Environmental PAC Oregon Wildlife Conservation Leaders Fund spokesperson Steve Petry said, quote, "Who's in the governor's office is really the person who gets to flip off and on all of our climate action," end quote. One of the state's biggest sources of political friction revolves around environmental politics, where outside of historically blue Portland, the eastern area of the state is home to both old-growth forests and a large logging industry. Petry maintains that legacy logging money has funded the state's right-wing causes over the years. While Drazen has criticized her opponent, Democrat Tina Kotek, over growing crime, sagging economic woes, and has linked her to current Governor Kate Brown's much-maligned performance, her ties with the logging industry and help from Knight may be components to help tip Oregon's gubernatorial scales. Kotek, meanwhile, is in no shortage of weighty supporters. Following a show of support from President Joe Biden's visit earlier this month, Senator Bernie Sanders Sanders made a trip to Oregon today in support of the Democratic nominee. Sanders was slated to visit rallies in both Eugene and Portland, backing Kotek and Democratic candidate for Oregon's 4th U.S. House District, Val Hoyle. Senator Elizabeth Warren made an appearance at a Kotek rally at the Wonder Ballroom on Saturday night in an enthusiastic show of support alongside Senator Jeff Merkley and the Decemberists. Grammy Award-winning Lizzo has also endorsed Kotek and is slated to appear in Portland November 4th in a show of support. Oregon's gubernatorial race is proving to be quite a nail-biter, with recent polls from 538 calculations showing Kotek and Drazen to be virtually neck and neck as the election nears. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Today marks the 25th anniversary of Oregon's first-in-the-nation law allowing medical aid in dying. The 1994 Death with Dignity law permits mentally capable people of making that decision. Suzanne Potter has more in the story.
The 1994 Death with Dignity law permits mentally capable people with less than 6 months to live to get a prescription for the medication approved by two doctors, which they can then choose to take in order to end their suffering. Barbara Coombs Lee, former president of the group Compassion and Choices, co-authored the law. She says it faced a long fight.
It was under constant assault for 12 years at the state and the federal level. I used to call this bill the little engine that could. It wasn't really finally resolved until 2006, when the last challenge was dismissed by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Attorney James Bopp Jr. with the National Right to Life organization led the fight against Oregon's law. He argued unsuccessfully that pain control made the law unnecessary and that it would prevent depressed terminally ill adults from making an informed decision. In the past 25 years, only about 5,000 terminally ill Americans have used a medical aid in dying prescription. Later, the state of Oregon shortened the waiting period and waived the state residency requirement. Today, 9 states plus Washington, D.C. permit medical aid in dying. Current president and CEO of Compassion and Choices, Kim Callinan, notes, however, that 4 out of 5 Americans live in a state where medical aid in dying is not authorized.
Medical aid in dying brings about a profound amount of peace of mind, not just for the dying person, but also for everybody within a state who might potentially want the option of medical aid in dying.
Currently, about a dozen states are considering or will soon consider medical aid in dying legislation. Governor Kate Brown has declared today end-of-life options day in Oregon. For Oregon News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Employees of a Washington State museum have collected more than 400 signatures on a community letter as they seek to unionize. Roz Brown reports they're planning a weekend rally.
Employees of the Tacoma Art Museum have collected more than 400 signatures of community support as they seek to unionize the institution founded in 1935. Stephen Rue prepares exhibits at the museum and says a majority of workers have indicated they want to join the Washington Federation of State Employees and become the state's first museum with unionized workers across departments. Rue believes a recent management resignation and other disruptions suggest it's the appropriate time for more employee engagement.
Unionizing would solidify our voice as the workers, but also give us a voice in order to implement those changes that need to be made.
Workers are seeking voluntary recognition for the union from museum management, but haven't heard if that will be accepted. A solidarity rally will be held across the street from the museum on Saturday at 2 p.m. Institutional giving manager Eden Redman believes unionization could help guarantee livable wages, safe working conditions, and accountability from management. She says that would help create a layer of worker advocacy and support.
A union would provide regular opportunities for feedback, would provide guaranteed opportunities for evaluations and opportunities for promotion, making those foundational practices across the institution.
Carrie Morton is a visitor service representative for the museum. She says there are 27 eligible workers who have signed union authorization cards.
We do have 90% of the eligible workers that are in support of the union. So it gives a pretty clear mandate, at least among the union eligible employees, this is the way that we want to go forward.
Morton says wages at the museum, between $15 and $17 per hour, are not enough to live on in Tacoma and force many employees to take on second jobs. For Washington News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in depth on Measure 112. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio with a focus on music. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, clouds roll in, temperatures down to 46. Tomorrow's weather, rain and 55 for the high. Today in history, on this date in 1904, the New York City subway made its inaugural run. It soon became America's largest subway system. Every day, it moves 4.5 million people. Our quote of the day is from investor Warren Buffett. Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway. The Environmental Protection Agency is rolling out the first $1 billion of its Clean Bus program. Candidates for Florida governor go head-to-head in a debate. And the United Kingdom has a new prime minister. With more on the stories impacting democracy, here's 2022 Talks.
Every day, millions of our children ride to school, an experience that for many in this country is a quintessential part of being a kid in America. But traditional school buses that transport our children rely on internal combustion engines that emit pollution in the air.
On Wednesday, Michael Regan, administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, announced a $1 billion investment for electric school buses across the U.S., part of the bipartisan infrastructure law, designed to aid school districts with the transition to low or zero emission vehicles. Regan was joined by local elected officials in Seattle, along with Vice President Kamala Harris, who sees electric school buses as a victory in the battle against climate change and promising for growing the job market.
We know that domestic manufacturing means that we can create jobs right here in the United States. And that by creating these jobs, because we are creating a new industry, we must also then think about what the jobs require, which is highly skilled labor.
Rishi Sunak has succeeded Liz Truss as British Prime Minister. He acknowledged his predecessor, saying, while she began the job with good intentions, mistakes occurred. He spoke about some of the issues currently plaguing the UK.
Right now, our country is facing a profound economic crisis. The aftermath of COVID still lingers. Putin's war in Ukraine has destabilized energy markets and supply chains the world over.
During the Florida governor's debate, things were heated between Democratic opponent Charlie Crist and incumbent Governor Ron DeSantis. Crist alluded numerous times that DeSantis might not serve a full term as governor, eyeing a run for president in 2024 instead.
We have a housing crisis in our state. Good luck buying a home, good luck renting an apartment. And it's because Governor DeSantis has taken his eye off the ball. He's focused on running for president in 2024, and as a result, we have lost things in our state budget, specifically a housing trust fund that has hundreds of millions of dollars that he, along with the legislature, have cut. I would restore it.
DeSantis skirted the issue and made his intentions for a second term clear.
Well, listen, I know that Charlie's interested in talking about 2024 and Joe Biden, but I just want to make things very, very clear. The only worn-out old donkey I'm looking to put out to pasture is Charlie Crist.
Finally, a Fulton County, Georgia judge ordered Mark Meadows, former White House chief of staff, to testify in the investigation of whether former President Donald Trump illegally tried to influence the state's 2020 election. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
In 2020, there was a 14% increase in the average student voting rate for American college campuses when compared to 2016. College students are busy studying and working jobs to support their education. As Mike Moen reports, some say that's why institutions of higher learning should give them a break on Election Day by pausing normal schedules.
To keep college students engaged with the voting process, an Election Day holiday for campuses is being floated. At least one Minnesota school is going that route again this fall, amid calls nationally for similar moves. At Temple University in Pennsylvania, students are circulating petitions to not hold classes on Election Day. In Minnesota, Augsburg University declared such a holiday for the 2020 vote, and the school's Rachel Ferris says they're now doing it for each fall election. College students often are surrounded by civic debate and outreach efforts, but Ferris says awareness about voting doesn't always reach them.
Overcoming the information hurdle and making sure
students know all the options available to them if there are hurdles that will get in their way of actually showing up to vote on election day. So how do I vote in advance? How do I vote by mail?
And amid higher college costs, the need for more part-time jobs to afford tuition is seen as another barrier. In 2020, the average student voting rate for all colleges and universities in the U.S. was 66%. Those findings are from the National Study of Learning, Voting, and Engagement, which is tied to the Institute for Democracy and Higher Education at Tufts University. Vera says making the Election Day holiday permanent aligns with Augsburg's mission to educate influence citizens. She adds having this day off isn't just about casting a ballot.
It also allows all the people in our community time and space to assist others in voting, whether as poll workers or by volunteering to transport people to the polls. So it's about a deeper level of engagement.
On the national level, supporters of the movement acknowledge there's not as much urgency compared to the 2020 election. They say that's why it's important for schools to at least have plans in place to help students vote if classes will still be held. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
A California tribunal claims that $40 billion in a school compensation fund is not enough. Congresswoman Mary Peltola is endorsed by a top Alaska Native organization. And a conference honors Chief Looking Horse. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal says that a $40 billion welfare settlement to compensate Native children and families does not satisfy all the requirements of the tribunal's orders. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
The tribunal is urging the parties involved in the agreement to continue negotiating despite its decision. Ottawa was ordered by the tribunal 3 years ago to compensate First Nations children and families after it had ruled they had been discriminated against for years because child welfare services on reserves were not properly funded. The initial deal announced at the beginning of the year would have awarded $40,000 to each child and their families that suffered, but the tribunal is now worried about the timeline for people to opt out and whether all children will get the full amount. Cindy Blackstock is the executive director of the First Nations Child and Caring Society of Canada.
It also turned out that some children would see their amount from $40,000 turn to nothing. And those are children who were removed during a child welfare investigation on reserve because their families were denied prevention services. But they may have stayed with a friend's family or whatever. And our message to Canada and to the class action lawyers was, make sure you don't leave these people behind.
Blackstock says it's not just a handful of children that are affected, but it could be in the thousands. The Assembly of First Nations says the tribunal's decision is devastating. The government has also expressed disappointment in the decision. The original agreement set aside $20 billion for individual compensation and $20 billion for long-term reform of the on-reserve child welfare system. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Alaska Federation of Natives, the largest statewide Native organization in Alaska, has endorsed Representative Mary Peltola for Congress. Peltola made history in September, becoming the first Alaska Native person, Yupik, to ever serve in Congress. She spoke before the Alaska Federation of Natives annual convention last week in Anchorage. The Democrat talked about unity and expressed her gratitude to the late Republican Congressman Don Young, whose seat she won in a special election. In an interview with National Native News, Peltola commented on serving Alaska Native and American Indian people, saying as a member of Congress, it's her job to uphold trust and treaty responsibilities.
So often what I've seen is this relationship where an agreement is made and then a generation goes by and institutional knowledge is forgotten of this, of all of the concessions that were made to get to this treaty, and then the next generation wants more concessions. And then the next generation wants more concessions from Alaska Natives and Native Americans. And I just think it's really important that as we're being approached with more concessions, we all remember collectively this institutional knowledge of the compromises and concessions that were made to get to that initial place, and not to keep ratcheting it down.
Peltola is running in the general election to keep her seat. In a press release Wednesday, the AFN stated the Alaska Native community is determined to help elect representatives and partners to achieve further self-determination and legal empowerment as sovereign, self-governing Indigenous peoples. The AFN has also endorsed U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski. The Association of Tribal Archives, Libraries, and Museums Conference is underway in California. Guardians of Culture and Lifeways were honored Wednesday. The Tribal Leader Award was Chief Arvel Looking Horse from the Cheyenne River Reservation in South Dakota. He's the 19th generation keeper of the Sacred White Buffalo Calf Pipe. He founded the World Peace and Prayer Day along with the Bigfoot Riders, which memorializes the massacre of Bigfoot's band at Wounded Knee. In his speech, he called for peace and that everyone is a messenger to protect Mother Earth. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The state of Montana has bought almost 6,000 acres for public use. Edwin J. Vieira reports local agencies say this could benefit wildlife conservation efforts despite some opposition, and the proceeds will also help to build a new children's hospital.
The Montana Land Board has approved acquiring a new piece of land to become a wildlife management area. In a 4-to-1 vote, the board acquired more than 5,000 acres at the base of the Big Snowy Mountains. Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has cited the lack of public access to the mountains as a primary factor for an elk population that's 900% over objective. Initially, the land belonged to Forrest Allen of Cody, Wyoming, and it was donated after his death in 2019 to a children's hospital. Local rancher Dick Rats described how this parcel of land went from being privately owned to its current status.
Forrest Allen willed the land to show their children's hospital in Helena, a longtime facility for children in need in Montana, and he also stipulated that he would like to see that land become a resource for the public.
State Attorney General Austin Knudsen was the lone dissenting vote. Though many community members supported this deal, its opponents would rather see the land put to use in agriculture instead of wildlife preservation. The new area should be open to the public next May. Doug Krings with the Montana chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers finds protecting an area of land this large is rare. As more people move to Montana, he sees increasing pressure for what he calls a trophy ranch, meant for wildlife preservation. He feels this is a unique opportunity for the state.
Most of the land within that area is in private ownership, which means it's heavily vested in agriculture. So where the timber meets the prairie, I mean, it's a habitat type that's not often protected in natural settings. And although this will have some managed grazing on this wildlife management area, this will probably allude to more wildlife.
Krings predicts in 5 or 10 years, hunters will be looking for smaller pieces of land to connect public lands that will be managed differently for the benefit of wildlife. He's convinced the new wildlife management area being open to the public is not only a benefit to Montanans, but to anyone looking to observe the wildlife and the landscape. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 27, 2020.